Welcome everybody. This is the 10th lecture in our course on women in Indian Buddhism, organized by the Numata Center of Buddhist Studies and the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative, both at the University of Hamburg. And today it is my great pleasure to welcome Alice Collette, who will speak to us on the topic of women in early Buddhist inscriptions. Alice Collette received her MA in Buddhist Studies from the University of Bristol and her PhD from Cardiff University. Postdoctorally, her research has focused on women in early Indian Buddhism, and she has published several articles and book chapters on the topic. In 2013, her edited volume was published as part of the South Asia Research Series, OUP, New York, which is entitled Women in Early Indian Buddhism, Comparative Textual Studies. Since her PhD, Dr. Collette has worked in several universities in the UK and North America and received several grants to support her research. She lives in York, UK, and is senior lecturer at York St. John University. She is currently working on a new project on women in early Buddhist inscriptions, and also beginning work with an Indian filmmaker for a documentary on gender and sexuality in Indian Buddhism and Indian Buddhist art. So much for introduction, and now I hand over to Alice Collette.
Okay, so I'm just starting now then. Any of you who didn't know, I can't hear Anale, so he just said as soon as the pictures comes onto me, I start. So thank you for the introduction that you've just given me, which I couldn't hear, obviously. okay, so today then I'm going to be talking about women in early Buddhist inscriptions. So from what I know of the course that you've done so far, it's textual evidence that you've been looking at mostly. So today will be a little bit different from the other lectures as we're looking at inscriptions. So the lecture today is based on research from my next book, which is going to be on women in early Buddhist inscriptions. Now, with regard to the people who are taking this course and the people who have signed up for it, and not just the people here today, but all the people that will access it afterwards, because I don't know many of you personally, it was hard for me to know exactly where to pitch the lecture. So the lecture has two parts to it. So firstly, I'm going to do a general overview about Indian inscriptions from this time period, where they might be, where we might find them, the sorts of things that they would say, and then looking at Indian inscriptions in general from this time period, and also Indian inscriptions by and about women from this time period. And then I'm going to look at one particular theme in detail, and that's based on an article of mine that's just about to come out called Women as Teachers and Pupils in Early Buddhist Communities, The Evidence of Epigraphy, and that will be in Religions of South Asia, coming out in the next few months. So with regard to the book and the article, you know, the obvious question with the inscriptions, I think, is so what do the inscriptions, the reason to write a book or research, what do these inscriptions tell us about the lives of women from this time? And also, and this as well in the context of this course that you're doing, do they confirm the textual evidence? Do they say the same as the textual evidence is telling us? Or do they challenge the textual evidence? Do they contradict the textual evidence? And I think where we are with research on the inscriptions at the moment, both of those things we can say are the case. So sometimes the inscriptions confirm what we find in the textual evidence, and sometimes they challenge or contradict what we have in the textual evidence. But then, you know, the textual evidence contradicts itself sometimes as well. So, yeah. So the sort of time period that I'm talking about with the inscriptions, for the book, I'm saying at the moment the time period is 300 BCE to 300 CE. Now the book is going to be on inscriptions in South Asia, so India and Sri Lanka. And it's that Sri Lanka ones that come to the 300 CE mark and a bit after that. So for today, I'm not going to talk about the Sri Lankan ones today particularly. And I'm not going to talk about Sri Lankan ones at all, just focusing on Indian inscriptions today. So generally speaking, then, today, the time period I'm talking about is more these four centuries, 200 BCE to 200 CE. But I will mention some inscriptions that come just slightly before that, which are the first decipherable inscriptions we have that, and the first inscriptions that mention Buddhist nuns. Okay, so to start off with a kind of general overview and some general comments about Indian inscriptions from this period. So where do we find Indian inscriptions from this period, and what sort of Indian inscriptions are they? And both, where do we find them, where do we find inscriptions generally, and where do we find the ones about women, and what are they generally, and what are they about the ones by or about women? So in India, we find a lot of inscriptions at Buddhist monument sites, monument sites called stupas. So Sanchin Amaravati being two of probably the best known stupa sites in India, and two sites at which we do find quite a lot of inscriptions by women. So we also find inscriptions generally and inscriptions by women at cave sites. So some of these cave sites are sites for dwelling, and some of them have bigger spaces as well, which are spaces for religious practice. So some of them are bigger cave sites or smaller cave complexes, as it were, and some of them are smaller cave sites. I think that's all I wanted to say about that one. So the spread of them, again, because I don't know much about all of this audience I'm having, I thought some of you might not know that much about India or ancient India, although you'll know something now you've come to this part of the course if you're doing the whole course. But anyway, to situate the sites in modern India for you, So we have New Delhi at the top, so about 100 kilometres south of New Delhi we have an important site there, and then Bhopal, which is here on this map if you go straight down from Delhi, just north east of Bhopal we have another site, and then going over to, in your screen, when you look at your screen to the left, to modern day Pune, we have some inscriptions not far from Pune, 20-25 kilometres away, and that western coastal area, we have some of the western coastal sites there. And then moving over to the other side of this map, slightly below Pune on the other side, is Hyderabad. And if we go east from Hyderabad, we find other insights. Other sites, monument and cave sites there. So we have, and these are both sites, important Buddhist sites, sites where we find inscriptions, and sites where we find inscriptions by women. So you can see from that it's really over this whole swathe of central India, central and northern India, where we find these inscriptions by women. As I said in my book, I will be looking at the inscriptions in Sri Lanka as well, but I won't be focusing on those today. Okay, so this wave of northern and central India then is the area of the Mauryan Empire. So during the Mauryan Empire, the Mauryan Empire was from the 4th to the 2nd centuries CE, and during the Mauryan Empire, the inscriptions of Ashoka, who is the best known of all the Maurans. The inscriptions of Ashoka, one of the Mauran empires, one of the Mauran emperors, it's on his inscriptions that we first find mention of Buddhist women. So Ashoka says that the Buddhist community is a fourfold community, and it's a community of Buddhist monks, Buddhist nuns, Buddhist laymen, and Buddhist lay women. So these are the first inscriptions that we have that mention Buddhist women. Okay. So where are the inscriptions? As I said, we find inscriptions at these monument sites and cave sites. So this is probably the best known, one of the best known of Buddhist monument sites in India. This is the site at Sanchi. So these Buddhist monuments are, you find them actually all over India and in many, many countries of the world now. So these monument sites, known as stupa sites, known as stupas, or their sites with their complexes, so they have several of these Buddhist monuments which are known as stupas. So originally, these monuments or stupas were considered to be the place where the remains of the Buddha were kept, and so were and became places of Buddhist practice and Buddhist worship. So this is a typical stupa site, and they have this typical, the stupa, these monuments have this typical dome shape. And there is an account by a Chinese pilgrim who travelled in India in the 7th century who tells the story of what he was told about why the stupas are this shape. And according to this account by the Chinese pilgrim, the stupas are this shape because the monks and the nuns asked the Buddha before he died, how do you want us to remember you? And the Buddha took off his outer robe and folded it into a rectangular shape, which would be the base shape of the stupa, and took his alms bowl and put his alms bowl on top of that and said, you should build monuments like this, and you should, it should be at these monument sites that you remember me and worship me. So that's an account by, as I say, a Chinese pilgrim travelling in India as to why stupas are this shape. So at these stupa sites then, we have, as we have the, with this one in Sanchi, railings and gateways and ornate gateways, as you can see here. And the inscriptions we find on the railings or on the pillars. And these inscriptions, the inscriptions by women that I'm going to talk about today, these are donor inscriptions. So what we might have in the image that you can see here, say at the bottom of one of those pillars on the gateway, we might find, for example, an inscription that says, this is the gift, this pillar is the gift of the nun so-and-so. Or this pillar is the gift of the monk so-and-so, or the same with the railings. These railings are the gift of the monk or the nun so-and-so. So we'd have these donor inscriptions, and that's generally what we have at these stupa sites. You can see from the picture before that we have carvings on these ornamented gateways, and these often depict images from the life of the Buddha, or just are ornamented in other ways. That is an inscription. I'm sorry if it hasn't, if you can't see it very well. I mean, it is quite faint. So this is an inscription, and you can see behind there the railings that are similar to the image that I've just shown you. So this is a typical inscription that we might have. So on one of these pillars, we might have an inscription like this. Some of the inscriptions are really quite short, and some of them would just say, for example, this is the gift of nun so-and-so, But some of them are longer as well, and the longer ones might say something along the lines of, in the year so-and-so, in the month so-and-so, on the day of this monk or these monks or this nun or these nuns made this inscription, made this donation of this pillar for the sake of their parents, for the sake of the Buddhist community, for the sake of all Buddhas, something like that. So that's generally the kind of form that the longer ones would take, the longer ones of these donor inscriptions. So second site, Amaravati, another well-known site, and this one here, as Buddhism died out in India, the monument sites fell into disuse. The stone was taken from some of the monument sites to be used for other things, but you can see from the remains of Amaravati here that this was a stupa similar to the Sanchi one that I just that I've just shown you, and you can see as well the remains of railings too. So as I said, with this one, what happened when the sites fell out of use is that other people would take stones from here for their own use, and actually one of the inscriptions made by a woman, one of the donor inscriptions made by a woman, in the 1700s there was a wealthy landowner who took some of the stones from Amaravati to create another temple nearby, and one of the donor inscriptions by women from Amaravati now makes up part of the entrance to one of this other temple. So that's Amaravati as it is now, but what we have in this is now, this relief is now in the British Museum. What we have is this, an artist at Amaravati, and this is dated to the 4th century CE, decided to carve an impression of Amaravati at the time. So we do have an idea of what the Amaravati stupa looked like at the time, and we can see from this impression the same sort of thing that we saw with the Sanchi one, with the railings and gateways, etc. And so combining the remains with this carved stone relief of what Amaravati looked like, some people have made drawings of what the Amaravati stupa would have looked like, which, as you can see, is very, very similar to the Sanchi one that I showed you, with again the railings and gateways. So again, you find the same sorts of inscriptions here, inscriptions that are donor inscriptions, donations of railings, of pillars, etc. Okay, so generally then, with regard to types of inscriptions, what types of inscriptions do we have from this period? I mean, I've put them in bullet points here, but it's not actually the case that they're in the types can be divided up quite as separately and neatly as this. So we have royal edicts. I've mentioned the inscriptions of Ashoka. So we have royal edicts from kings, and then we also have inscriptions from by queens as well, by queens and princesses. But some of the inscriptions by queens and princesses are donor inscriptions. And then thirdly, we have land grants and inscriptions about other legislative matters. So these would be inscriptions that talk about monastic and other sorts of property, or usually these are inscriptions which might say something along the lines of this field is given to so-and-so monastery or so-and-so nunnery. So that's types of inscriptions, and then types of inscriptions by or about women. So you can see we have the same sort of things here. The royal inscriptions by queens and princesses actually cover a range of different subjects and topics. But as I say, we have things that are both royal and donor inscriptions as well. So queens and princesses making these donations of what might be the railings, the pillars, etc. And then donor inscriptions are those ones that I'm going to talk about today from cave sites or monument sites, and then land grants and other legislative matters. Women can be mentioned on there, those, and nuns can be mentioned on those. And particularly, I find those particularly interesting because some of them do tell us about where nunneries were, so where nuns were living. Okay, so that's a bit of a general overview with regard to Indian Buddhist inscriptions from this time period and ones that particularly are by or about women. So as I said, what I'm going to do now then is just take a bit of a more detailed look at some of these inscriptions. And I'm just going to look at one aspect or one theme in relation to the inscriptions, and that is the subject of women as teachers and pupils as expressed on the inscription. And as I said, why would we be interested in the epigraphic evidence? Why would we be interested in the inscriptions? Well, partly we want to ask the questions and try to answer the questions. What might the inscriptions tell us that's different to the textual evidence? Do the inscriptions confirm the textual evidence? Do they contradict it? Okay. So with regard to this topic of women as teachers and pupils, firstly then, before we go on to looking at the inscriptions, what is it that the texts tell us about this topic of women as teachers and pupils? Well, there are contradictions within the textual evidence. So if we look at just the Pali Canon, and I think in the course so far, you will be aware of the different texts in different languages, and we'll have done some work or listened to some of the lectures on texts in Pali from the Theravada tradition. So contradictions with regard to the textual evidence on the topic of women as teachers and pupils, particularly women as teachers. So there does seem to be so we do know, and it's quite commonly discussed these days, that the Pali Canon are texts which we would call layered texts, meaning that some parts of them were written at some time and other parts of them were written at another time. So we have contradictions with regard to women as teachers and pupils in these Pali texts, because on the one hand we have stories and accounts of venerated female teachers, female monastic teachers, so venerated nuns who are very competent, very able in their ability to teach, seem to be considered to be on a par with male teachers and also themselves teach men. So just to take the example of Kemar, the discourse on Kemar, in this discourse a king goes to a particular region and says to one of his men, I would be interested in having some discourse with a Brahmin or an ascetic in the area. Can you find out who's in the area? And it's suggested to him that he goes to visit the Buddhist nun Kemar. Which he does, and he puts questions to Kemar and they engage in debate, and the king goes away satisfied and impressed with what Kemar has taught him with her level of knowledge, and he's even more impressed later when he then meets the Buddha, and he puts the same questions to the Buddha, and he sees that there's very much an accord between what the disciple Kemar said and what the Buddha said. So these stories or accounts of female teachers in the text make the female teachers look very wise, very able, very competent, very insightful. But then also what we have in the text is An institutionalized, formal method by which nuns are instructed. So according to the text, then it would be the case that a chosen monk would go to instruct the nuns every 2 weeks. So it wouldn't always be the same monk, and this is the role of monk advisor to the nuns. So there is a need for the monks to have, for the nuns to have instruction from the monks, and then every 2 weeks a chosen monk, it wouldn't always be the same monk. The idea is that there are a certain set of monks who would be the ones who go to instruct the nuns. So there's this formal mode of instruction for nuns. Now, we can't really tell from the textual evidence, like, for example, how many monks there would be in a particular area that would be able to do this, would be able to act as monk advisor to the nuns. But if we were to say, for example, we might imagine that in one area there might be 6 monks who could each go and instruct the nuns, then we would be able to say that actually then the nuns who were instructed under this formal method of instruction wouldn't see any of those monks very often. If there was a group of 6 monks who took it in turns, the nuns wouldn't see the monks very often. And this becomes important, actually, in what I'm going to say next about the inscriptions. So in this formalized schema of monks needing to advise the monks and the nuns, from how this looks like when we look at the textual evidence, don't look to be in particularly close teacher-disciple relationships. And of course the question is, if we look back at these venerable, venerated female teachers, why would the nuns even need a monk to go and teach them if there were very able and capable nuns who could do that? So this potentially looks like a contradiction in the text. Okay. So what does the evidence of inscriptions tell us about this? Well, the evidence of inscriptions accords with this idea of the venerated female teacher. So there are named teachers like Dhammadinda and Kemar, as we had in the Pali, named teachers, and their names appear on inscriptions made by the nuns who are their pupils. So it would say, and I've got some coming in a minute, so it would say this is the inscription of nun so-and-so who's the pupil of so-and-so teacher. So I've just got one example there. A nun makes makes a donation because she is a disciple of a named female teacher. Okay. And then also what we have on the inscriptions is evidence of nuns who record themselves to be direct disciples of male monastic teachers. So 2 examples, a nun makes a donation recording that she is a disciple of a named male teacher, or a monk and a nun make a donation recording they are the disciples of, they are each disciples of a named male teacher. So all of this together, what this tells us is, in this context, which is a context of Brahmanism, which for any of you who don't know, Brahmanism is what we call Hinduism, or if you like, what becomes Hinduism. Don't use the term Hinduism for this historical period. But in this historical context of Brahmanism, the idea of lineage and one's self-identity is defined in relational terms, so who you're related to. So the Brahminical or Hindu caste system, how one understands one's self-identity is in these relational terms, so it's to do with your family, your tribe, your clan, your caste. So what we have in these inscriptions, and these inscriptions by Buddhist nuns, when they talk about themselves in relational terms, they're talking in relation to their female teacher. So in this context, in which who you are related to is very important in terms of your self-identity, your social identity, and in terms of your social status. For the nuns to be talking about themselves just in relation to one female teacher is very important and actually shows us that these female teachers were particularly significant characters, so significant enough for the nuns to want to identify themselves just as a pupil of that female teacher. And then what the records of nuns who are direct disciples of male teachers shows us actually is that these seem to be much closer teacher-disciple relations than we would expect would be the case if we were to follow this idea of this formalized method of instructing nuns, whereby a chosen monk goes every couple of weeks to instruct the nuns. For nuns to say they are disciples of named male teachers suggests more of a relationship than we would think would be the case with the idea of the monk advisor to nuns. Okay, so before I go on to show you some of the inscriptions in detail, I just want to say a note about some of the grammar on the inscriptions. And that's in part because my argument in relation to the fact that we've got nuns with female teachers and nuns with male teachers, part of the argument is an argument based on grammar and the grammar of the grammar of the inscriptions, the Prakrit grammar. So actually, maybe I should say for any of you who don't know. So if you have followed the course up until this point, then you have been talking, or the other people giving the lectures have been talking about Sanskrit language, so you will know something about Sanskrit language. So the Prakrits are languages that are related to Sanskrit, and the Prakrits are the vernacular languages. Actually, Pali is one of the Prakrits, but there are other Prakrits as well. So the Prakrits share words with Sanskrit and share some of the grammar, but we could call them simplified form, so simpler languages than Sanskrit. And the Prakrit on the inscriptions is called, well, it used to be called monumental Prakrit, and now it's just termed inscriptional Prakrit. And this Prakrit is different to literary Prakrit, so Prakrit that's written in text. What else do you want to say about that? Oh, yeah. So, generally speaking, the inscriptions are written in Prakrit, but some of it is Prakrit that shows Sanskrit features. So, we could say that the Sanskrit, or is we do say the Sanskrit and the Prakrits are discrete languages. But actually, with regard to the inscriptions and what we find in text as well, because there are shared words and some grammatical forms, can be the case in text and is the case with inscriptions, that we have inscriptions in Prakrit. Some of the inscriptions are clearly just in Prakrit, but some of them are in Prakrit and have Sanskritic features. And then we do have inscriptions in Sanskrit as well. So some of the inscriptions that matter, a few of the inscriptions that matter in the time period that I'm talking about are fully in Sanskrit. And of the ones that I'm showing you, the matter ones have more Sanskrit features. So part of my argument as to us having nuns with female teachers is based on grammar, is based on these grammatical forms in the inscriptions, and also the nuns having male teachers. Part of the argument is also based on the grammar, which is why I wanted to say something about the grammar here. But actually, if you're someone who doesn't know much about all this, I think you can still follow the argument, even if you don't know much about these languages. And I'm just going to say one thing about the grammar, actually. which would just take, I think, about 5 minutes and then go on to the inscriptions. And, you know, all the inscriptions I've put in English as well. So if you're someone who doesn't know much about this, the languages, I think, you know, you can still follow this, and actually there's not very much of it either. Okay. So Prakrit grammar then. So Richard Solomon has called the Prakrit grammar, that is inscriptional Prakrit grammar, unstandardized and inconsistent. Now, as I said, part of the argument for these being nuns with female teachers and nuns with male teachers is based on the grammar of the inscriptions. So although it is the case that the grammar, Prakrit grammar we find in these inscriptions isn't always consistent and isn't always standard, the genitive endings that we find, which are the ones which are important here for this argument, these are standard and regular, generally speaking. Yeah, they don't follow. They're not perfect in any way, but generally speaking, they are standard and regular. Yeah. Maybe I just say as well, for any of you who don't have expertise in other languages. So genitive endings mean, as I said, the general form of the inscriptions might be, this is the gift of nun so-and-so. So a genitive ending would come with the, be on the end of the nun's name. So it would be that the form of the sentence would be, this is the gift of nun so-and-so, the genitive ending indicating it's of nun so-and-so. So it's these endings that tell us whether the inscription was made by a male or a female. So again, anyone who doesn't know the languages, I think this is just ignore this one. This is probably the most complicated, actually, of all the slides. I would say just look at what's in bold. That's really all you need to. So this is from Luddha's Introduction to Bahut Inscriptions, so inscriptions from another Buddhist monument site. And you can see here that he says genitive endings for men. So if it's inscription by monk so-and-so, then we would expect the name of monk so-and-so to have S-A on the end, as you see in the bold here. If it's the inscription of nun so-and-so, we would expect the name of nun so-and-so to have any of these three endings that we have on the end here, Y-A, Y-A, Y-E, okay? So this is what Luddha's found when he was looking at the Bahut inscriptions, the inscriptions from one Buddhist monument site. But actually, this is generally what we find. What he found is generally what we find. And here are some tables which are taken from Mahendranath's Historical Grammar of Inscriptional Prakrit. Now, I'm showing you these tables really just to show how stable this SA and YA, YA, YE endings are, just how stable they are. So I don't want to say that I'm agreeing with Mahendranath's dates here, or in fact with how he divides up the geography of India particularly, but you can just see, even just a quick look at these tables, you can see that it's SA, 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 and you can see how comprehensive this ending is. So as I say, the inscriptions would say the gift of monk so-and-so and would have the SA ending. Or for the women, the gift of nun so-and-so with the YA, long A, short A, the YA, YA, YE ending. So you can see here again, very regular and very standard these endings are. And really only a few examples of different ones of these endings. Okay. Okay, so this slide is called typical use of the genitive for those who aren't following the language part or not particularly interested in that. You'd also call this slide typical inscriptions, typical ones of these inscriptions. So the first one then is the male. So a very simple one, a very short one, as I said. Some of them are very simple and very short and just say the gift of monk so-and-so, gift of nun so-and-so, and some of them are a lot longer. So these are the general forms of them, and you can see here as well the use of the genitive. So the first one is male, and you can see on the end of the name, the SA ending. And then the second one is female, and you can see there on the end of the name, the YE ending. So this is a typical form. And then if it's added to, ways in which it's added to often include then more genitives, so more SAs or YAs, YAs, YEs. As you can see in the third one here, so this is the gift of a wife of a king. So you can see on her name we have the YE ending. And then you can see, well, the king's name is missing, but you can just see the KA there, which was the last letters of his name plus the genitive ending, the SA ending. Okay. So both here, examples of the genitive and examples of typical inscriptions. So typical inscriptions being gift of monk so-and-so or gift of nun so-and-so, who is the pupil of teacher so-and-so, or whichever relation they are putting themselves in. And here we have then some of these inscriptions that I've been talking about. So these ones from Sanchi. So here you can see these endings, and again, very simple inscriptions which don't really say very much, just the gift of a particular nun and a particular who describes herself as the pupil of a particular teacher, or the thing that has been donated is expressed. So the pillar is the gift of Mula, female pupil of named teacher. Yeah. So as I say, these inscriptions don't reveal much to us, but I think in this Brahminical context where lineage and who you're related to is a marker of your sense of identity, your sense of status in the world, I think that the fact that these nuns only define themselves in relation to a female teacher, that tells us something about the status and the significance and importance of these female teachers for the nuns making the inscriptions. Okay, so slightly longer inscriptions here. These ones from Mathura district. And these ones taking the form that I said the longer ones take. So here we have as I said, in a particular year during the reign of a particular king, in the month so-and-so, on the day so-and-so, the gift of so-and-so, nun, female, pupil of so-and-so, nun. Okay. So yeah, that's what you've got here basically with these two inscriptions. So I just give you a minute to read those, and you can read them in English or also you can see the endings again on these. So anyway, I'll just give you a minute to read them. Okay, so this is then more of the same, really, nuns with female teachers from other areas. So to show as well that nuns with female teachers, inscriptions from nuns with female teachers covers a range of these areas that I've been talking about. Yeah, so I just gave you a minute to read those as well. Okay, so turning now to nuns with male teachers. So I've got a few of these then. So the first one is from Amaravati. And in this one we have, this one is a little bit complicated because at the end of it, a couple of other women are mentioned who aren't particularly important for what I'm wanting to communicate about these inscriptions at the moment. So in this one then we have the male teacher Naga, and a monk disciple and a nun disciple. So the monk disciple and the nun disciple have made the donation together. So these are both disciples of the monk Naga, a male disciple and a monk disciple and a nun disciple, and they both made the donation together. So then a few more of these. So in the next one we have, again, a monk and a nun have made the donation together. It's a pillar gift this time, as you can see. And this time it's a monk and a nun, not who are disciples of the same teacher, but a monk and a nun who are disciples of two different teachers. Actually, as it turns out on this one, the name of the two different male teachers are quite similar. So we have Buddha Rakita and Buddha Rakita. So those are the two male teachers. And then we have Chula, the monk disciple, and Nada, the nun disciple. So a monk and a nun, each disciples of different male teachers, make this offering. So that's exciting. And then the second one we have, this is interesting in what the number of them have been so far. So here we have a gift of a female who's a pupil of a female teacher, and that female teacher is then the pupil of a male teacher. Yeah, so in this one we have a male, female, female lineage. Okay. And in these ones actually, those of you who are following the grammar in some of these, isn't the same as what I was talking about, but the ones that have different grammatical forms, I've gone into that in the article. So again, here we can see male-female lineages. And in the bottom one, there's quite a few different individuals mentioned, but we can still see Vijaya is the monk, and his pupil is Sapila, and her pupil is Bodhi, and then two other people are mentioned, but that we can see being the lineage in that one. Okay. So just to say something as well about this idea of pupil or disciple status. So this is the term used in the inscriptions is ante vasani, meaning pupil or disciple, got kind of a range of meanings. What I want to make clear about these inscriptions is that being a pupil or a disciple in this context doesn't necessarily mean that you yourself are low status. This we might assume from somebody saying that they are a pupil or a disciple, but I don't think we should assume that in these cases. So what we've seen already is that people who can be, some of these women are both pupils and teachers themselves. So therefore, if we try and assume that the pupil status is a low status, it would be hard then to understand how someone can be described as both a pupil themselves of a teacher and a teacher themselves of pupils. But I don't think we need to assume any kind of low status for this pupil-disciple role that they're defining themselves in. And we can see that for other reasons as well. So other people in this pupil-disciple status can have high status roles. So a good example of that is a nun called Buddhamitra, and there are actually three inscriptions that mention her. So she's known as a Tradhipitaka, and what this means is someone who knows well the collection of the canon, so the canonical collection being the Tripitaka, the three pitaka, the three baskets or the three collections. So Buddhamitra then has a clearly defined role, and those that are mentioned with clearly defined roles, we understand these to be kind of key figures. Perhaps we could say figures with a particular status, high status maybe we could say, but certainly key figures within these early Buddhist communities, ones that have these clearly defined roles. So Buddhamitra then, as well as having this clearly defined role, which we could potentially say high status role, also is a pupil of a monk. So as I'm saying then, this pupil status, we shouldn't assume that this pupil status means that the person in this pupil status is low status. So Buddhamitra has a clearly defined role, making her a key figure, we would say, I would think. Well, I don't know if key figure is exactly the right thing to say. Certainly someone very much within the network of, very clearly and centrally within the network of these early Buddhist communities. That's what we would expect these people with these defined roles to be. So she has a defined role, and she is talked about as a pupil of a male teacher as well. So I get, just give you a minute to read this one. As I said, there's this is just one of them on Buddhamitra, who is said to be someone who knows the Tripitaka, as does her monk teacher as well. Okay, and just to finish off with something on dates before I conclude. So I said at the beginning that the dates I'm talking about today are 4 centuries, say, from 200 BCE to 200 CE. So with regard to some of these inscriptions that I've been talking about, the inscriptions from Sanchi come from the ground balustrades of Stupa 1 and Stupa 2, and these parts of the Sanchi complex are dated to the Shunga period. So this is the period that falls just either side of the common era. So 2nd to 1st centuries BCE and just going into the 1st century CE as well. Yeah. The script characters are early script characters. Yeah. For those and those of you who don't know about the languages, so this is just the script that the language is written in. We can The script that the language is written in was used for a long time, and so there are certain features of it which are features which we have on the earliest inscriptions, and some of the characters change a bit when they are written in subsequent centuries. So argument based on paleography, meaning we can look at how the script changes in different periods and design. I don't know who. Can I wait till you've just posted a question? I'll just wait till I finish that, I think. Is that all right? Yeah. Okay, thanks. Then the inscriptions from Amaravati, most of those can be dated to the first or second centuries of the Common Era with one possible exception. I won't go into that exception, but that's in the article. And then three of the inscriptions have dates, and these are the ones from Mathura, and these inscriptions can be dated during the reign of Hubishka, a Kushana king, and so can be dated to the 2nd century CE. So the inscriptions from the cave sites are the most difficult to date. And people who have worked on the cave sites would say that the inscriptions in the cave sites potentially come from quite an expanse of time. And from what I can work out, it seems that the inscriptions by women could potentially, some of them could be as early as the 2nd century BCE, and some of them certainly going into the 1st century CE. Okay, so to conclude then, so as I said at the beginning, these inscriptions by women, there's a spread to them over a swathe of North and Central India. So both of these phenomena, the phenomena of nuns with female teachers and nuns with male teachers, none of these seem to be particularly region-specific. And then the dates, as I said, they can be dated on paleographic grounds and go over this broad period of 4 centuries. So, yeah, this epigraphic evidence provides us with names of female monastic teachers who would otherwise be excluded from history. Those of you who do know and study this area or have done this course so far, we have quite a lot of names in the text, but the inscriptions give us other names and new names as well. And also, I think it's important to remember in this context the importance of lineage and genealogy. So that when nuns define themselves just in relation to a female teacher, that in itself should be considered to be something significant. And lastly, just to say again, this pupil status, we don't need to think of that as being something that's a low status, and that, you know, the evidence suggests that Antevasini is a marker of identity, which demonstrates the nuns were important figures. And it does seem like from the inscriptions these nuns are interwoven into the social nexus of early Buddhist communities. Some were teachers, perhaps exalted ones, others established themselves as actors within lineages, and others had defined roles which show they were significant figures in early Buddhist communities. So I hope then what I've shown you here, what I've attempted to show you, is that the inscriptions can add to our understanding of and the picture that we build of women in early Buddhist traditions. The inscriptional evidence does seem to both sometimes confirm the textual evidence and sometimes challenge the textual evidence. And in this case, as I said, there are some things in some of the texts which don't seem to accord with what the inscriptions seem to tell us, particularly this idea of close male-female teacher-disciple relationships, or closer than we might expect from what some of the texts tell us. Okay, so that's the end of the lecture, and there is a bibliography on the slides, which you can access any time that you want to. Okay, so I guess now I'll turn straight to the question, because I have got a question already. I think it's a question or something anyway. Okay. Right, hold on. No, I think that because someone else is writing, I can't see all of your question. Oh, good to read aloud. Okay, you want me to read the question aloud? Okay, quite long. Okay, so the terminology used on the inscriptions of Antivasini for disciple seems to me to be Vinaya-based terminology. Nuns are required to stay with their preceptor for 2 years, and in addition to that, for 5 years with their personal monastic teacher. This dependency period may or may not overlap with living with the teacher. Therefore, the presence of such terminology may not be so special in terms of signaling identity and identification with female teachers as such as against male teachers. Oh, sorry. And the male teacher would be a bhikkhuni responsible for giving exhortation to the bhikkhunis on the occasion of the upasatha, to be formally appointed by the bhikkhu sangha and agreeable to the bhikkhunis. The terminology may be maintained out of politeness or affection even after the legal period of mentorship had elapsed. I don't think I was trying to say that the terminology was special in terms of signifying a female teacher. I was saying really that the terminology is, and actually no, I wasn't saying that the terminology Antivasini is what makes these female teachers seem important. It's more like simply the fact that they're the things that the nuns relate them to, is more what I was saying, is important. The simple fact that nuns relate themselves just to female teachers. And we saw some of them where, we had, a lineage of three. So, firstly, a nun who thoughts about herself as a pupil of a female teacher, who then talks about them as a pupil of a male teacher. So what I was saying really is, it's interesting that some of them just are about women, so that they don't mention the monk who might be the teacher of the other female teacher as well. The fact that they just identify themselves as pupils of women is what I was saying is important. So, next question. Can we say that the affiliation of nuns to monks expressed in the inscriptions goes against what we have in texts? Are there any instances in the text where such an affiliation is made a topic? Yes, not that I know of, actually. I don't know if you know of any yourself, but not that I know of. To me, it seems quite different, actually, to what we have in the text from what I've for my research and what I've seen so far. Next question. My thoughts about being a pupil. Everyone must have been a pupil to someone, and the teacher's names on the inscriptions may be dead at the time of making the inscriptions. So being a pupil should, as you say, not be a grading, but something that just shows the nun's lineage. Yeah, Yeah, I agree. And actually I think some of the other grammar that I didn't go into might be grammar that's indicating a deceased teacher, actually. And that's in the article. But every nun has to have a female teacher, and now because there are so many comments, I don't know what you're responding to when you say that. But every nun has to have a female teacher. Well, oh, so you're writing again. Not according to the inscriptions, they don't. Yeah. The point I was trying to make is that to name one's monastic preceptor teacher in traditional Indian culture and contemporary Buddhist context too is a sort of default identifier, i.e. to say monk X or nun Y were ordained under preceptor Z and is his or her disciple. Yes, it is a kind of default identifier, but then I think it's an interesting question as to why it's become a default identifier, actually. Why it is the case that Buddhist tradition is like that. So next comment then from Petra again. In relation to her comment, but every nun has to have a female teacher. This is because you wonder about the differences in the inscriptions of nuns having female teachers and others who have male teachers. So, I'm still not really sure. It's not a question, I think you're just, I don't know if it is a question or what, sorry. I think in some ways actually it's a bit of a detailed discussion to be having. With only me being able to speak and then read what the rest of you are saying. Yeah. So this is in addition to your previous questions. So your previous questions being, can we say that the affiliation of nuns to monks expressed in the inscriptions goes against what we have in the text? So yes, I'm sorry, but I'm still not quite following it, and I think this is to do with Petra. I'm still not quite following because I think this is to do with the fact that we can't speak to each other. So I don't know how to respond actually. I can't quite follow everything that you're commenting on or asking actually. I'm very sorry about that. Don't know if there's anything we can do about that now, really, at the moment. Sorry, if it's alright with you, I'm just gonna move on then to Analia's question. Which is, I'm not sure I fully understand, the point you made about high and low status. Please correct me if I got you wrong, but what I understood you say is that to be a pupil is not in itself a low position because a pupil of someone could still be a teacher of others. But you are not questioning in principle the fact that a teacher is higher than his or her pupil. Yes, no, I wasn't questioning that. I was just saying that to anybody who is coming to this and thinking something along the lines, or if someone is just defined in the pupil role, then that probably means they are someone who's low status in the community. But I was just trying to say that actually, it can be the case that somebody, could still even be an elder, because they would always been, as someone else said on here, they would always have been a pupil themselves of someone else. So they might have other roles and they might be high status in other ways, but still be the pupil of someone else who would still, of course, be their teacher and the one that they would respect. So I wasn't saying anything, I wasn't challenging the idea that someone wouldn't venerate their teacher. I think they always would venerate their teacher. It's just that it doesn't necessarily mean they're being in a pupil role means that they're only pupils or that they're only students. Okay. And then, I'm eager to read your upcoming book. What's the title again? Do you mean the book on inscriptions? If it's that book, I'm still working on that book. But this, what I've been talking about here is based on an article that will be coming out in a few months, which is called, Women in Early Buddhist Communities. Women as Teachers and Pupils in Early Buddhist Communities, The Evidence of Epigraphy, which will be published in a journal called Religions of South Asia. And that will be coming out in a few months' time. Should be quite soon. I'm hoping it'll be quite soon. Right, yeah. So I can add it on here, I guess, then. Sorry to anyone who's just listening. So Anale says, if it comes out soon, please share it with all of us. So I can add it to something on here, on the module, accessible via the module. I will do that. Yeah, I will. If it comes out by, I guess it's closing around September. If it comes out before that, I'll do that. And Anale just said, yes, give it to me and I'll load it, and yes, I will. Okay. Okay, thanks. You're welcome. any other questions? So, I guess if there are any other questions, if there aren't any other questions, nobody's typing. Oh, somebody's typing. Oh, thanks. Yeah, thanks for explaining carefully for those of us not familiar with the topic. You're welcome. Like I said, carefully. Yeah, I understood that. Not knowing exactly who the audience is, it's quite hard to know where to pitch it. So, and presumably because you're saying all these things, you did follow it as well. So hopefully that means I pitched it at an introductory enough level, but also got communicated what I wanted to communicate. Yeah, so Nalia has written, thank you very much for the interesting lecture. Good to have the epigraphic material to counterbalance our emphasis on text, and especially for making an effort to remain comprehensible to students who are not so familiar with the topic. So I guess then, if there aren't any more questions, that we just finish here. But given that I can't hear Anale, I don't know how to stop it if we are stopping here. How do we do that then? Okay, so Nale says he's going to switch off now, and there's another comment. Thank you, very interesting. Okay, thank you. Recording is off.